You're listening to Making Waves.
My name is Laura Blackmore, and I'm the executive director of the Puget Sound Partnership, the state agency formed to lead our region's collective effort to protect and restore Puget Sound. Our online magazine, Making Waves, features stories about the people working to protect and recover Puget Sound. For this issue of Making Waves, we're holding a series of conversations with experts on themes related to Puget Sound recovery. These conversations include wide-ranging discussions about climate change, infrastructure and the environment, and environmental justice. For this interview, I'm speaking with David Trout, who has served as the Natural Resources Director for the Nisqually Indian Tribe since 1987. He's been the chair of the Puget Sound Salmon Recovery Council since 2012, and has served on the Puget Sound Partnership's Ecosystem Coordination Board since 2007. David also serves as chair of the Nisqually River Council and president of the Nisqually River Foundation. In his role as the Natural Resources Director for the Nisqually Indian Tribe, he heads a diverse department focused on salmon, shellfish, wildlife, and the environment in general. Throughout his career at the Nisqually Indian Tribe, he worked closely with the late Billy Frank Jr., the tireless advocate for tribal treaty rights and environmental stewardship. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Washington School of Fisheries, and he lives in Steilacoom with his wife and two sons. Two little known facts about David. He occasionally takes meetings from the wheelhouse of his boat, and he was twice included in Jay Leno's top news headlines. But a well-known fact about David is that he is a passionate advocate for salmon recovery and gives his heart to the work of protecting and restoring Puget Sound. David, thank you so much for joining us today. For our conversation, we're going to talk about the ways that infrastructure interacts with the environment, specifically with respect to salmon recovery and climate change. Are you ready?
I am ready, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm glad to be with you and all the folks that are viewing.
All right. So my first question is, a recent U.S. Geological Survey study paid for by the Nisqually Indian Tribe and the Washington State Department of Transportation stated that the section of I-5 that crosses the Nisqually River will soon be at risk of regular major flooding events. Sea level rise is also predicted to cause coastal squeezing, which will shrink the habitat available to salmon in the Nisqually River Delta. How are salmon affected by I-5 now? And how do you think they'll be affected in the future if we don't make changes to that section of I-5?
Well, thank you for that question, Laura. And it really is, it's a complicated weaving of a bunch of different stories. And to really fully understand it, we've got to go back a few years to when I-5 was built across the Nisqually Delta, originally on piers to allow the free movement of water upstream and downstream from the Nisqually River and McAllister Creek. But as a result of concerns and cost around maintenance of those structures, the Department of Transportation diked and filled in all of those elevated causeways across the Nisqually Delta, just leaving a handful of openings at the Nisqually River, at McAllister, and a couple of flood relief channels for the water to move upstream and downstream. And in essence, created a dam across the Nisqually Delta that has had major impacts on the environmental quantity and quality of habitat in the Nisqually, but also creates other kinds of concerns. And the I-5 crossing in the Nisqually Delta is this intersection of a bunch of different interests, which certainly includes salmon and treaty rights and things that depend on salmon, like southern resident killer whales, but also includes the local economies of the South Sound region. It includes communication lines that travel across the Nisqually River under the Nisqually Bridge, and certainly impacts national security issues with the potential overtopping and taking out of I-5 as a result of a major event. And so because of these connections and the importance of this crossing the Delta, we were able to get the attention of the Washington State Legislature a couple of bienniums ago to jointly or to fund WashDOT with tribal matching dollars to take a look at those risks and get a good assessment of what the chances of these kind of events occurring into the future, and also provide an understanding of the impact of salmon. And so the impact of salmon is large, and it's going on now and will go on to the future if things don't change. The The Nisqually Chinook are part of the ESA listed stock of Puget Sound and are vital for the recovery of the overall health of Puget Sound. And their survival is critical to that ESU recovery, the ecologically significant unit recovery. The Nisqually Delta is absolutely vital habitat to Chinook salmon. They are estuary dependent, and they spend a lot of time as juveniles, up to 6 weeks in the estuary, rearing and adapting to what will then become a saltwater environment from them becoming existing as a freshwater animal. And so the transition there is really important, and they need space and time to be able to do that. The Nisqually tribe has led an effort over the last 20 years to fully restore the Nisqually Delta. We have 90% of the historic Delta restored, and it's providing fabulous fish habitat and producing things that support not only Nisqually Chinook, but Chinook from all around the region, and salmon in the ecosystem. These estuaries are the most incredible productive areas on Earth. And so they're incredibly important to the things that we care about. And what we've noticed as we've monitored our work down there is that the conditions we hope to restore and reestablish are not developing as fast as we had hoped. And some of the areas that we have found to be absolutely critical to salmon survival are diminishing in scale in terms of size and time of use because of sea level rise. What would normally happen in a functioning estuary without a dam across the middle of it is that as sea level rise occurs, the habitats that are critical for fish would just naturally reestablish themselves upstream. So as that salt wedge moves further and further up the Nisqually River, if it weren't blocked by the I-5 dam, the critical habitats for fish would just simply march upstream with it. But because of that dam blocking upstream movement, the habitats that are critical for fish are becoming rarer. There's a particular habitat we've identified, this floodplain forested riparian habitat in the salt marsh, where up to 80% of our fall Chinook, our wild fall Chinook, will spend up to a month transitioning from that freshwater animal to a saltwater animal. And it's absolutely critical habitat. And what's so perfect about this habitat is that it can go from freshwater salinity on the surface of a zero salinity to being Puget Sound water on the bottom within 12 feet. And so the fish get to choose where they want to be based on their time there and their ability to adjust. And as they make the slow change, they become more and more adapted to salt water and then eventually move out into Puget Sound and out to the ocean and then come back in 3 and 4 and 5 years to the Nisqually River. But that first time where they're in the Nisqually Delta slowly adapting is absolutely critical. And what we've noticed is that it's becoming deeper and more saline over time because of sea level rise and the inability of the habitat to adjust to the sea level rise. So the quality of the habitat is definitely changing. The ability of Nisqually fish to survive in those habitats will be impaired over time. And so it's a critical factor for us. There are also other connections, and I mentioned them earlier, with the South Sound economy and the national security. 30% of the workforce of JBLM works in Thurston County and crosses the Nisqually River every day. And it's a major vital lifeline for connections between Seattle and Portland. And so our economy really depends on having that predictable transportation corridor. What we've noticed in our work, the tribe's work in the last 15 years, is that there is this very unnatural situation developing just upstream from I-5, across from Billy Frank's property, Frank's Landing, in the Wahilut Indian School, where over time the river has shifted and changed to the point where it's now flowing upstream and along a bend where all this energy is being directed in the wrong direction upstream. It's very likely that that's going to break through at some point, endanger I-5, probably taking out the north and southbound lanes for some prolonged period of time. It's also because of the dam structure blocking upstream movement of saltwater. It also impedes downstream movement of floodwaters. So 10,000 acres or more of private properties, including tribal properties, were flooded in 1996 during our last major flood event. And the result was significant damage to private properties. And the water stayed for 2 weeks because there just isn't proper drainage across that I-5 dam. And so it created significant harm to private property owners, including tribal members. And so all of these factors sort of all came together to the legislature saying, we've got to take a closer look at this and let's really identify what the risks are. And that USGS study that you referred to in the question has identified that within the next 17 years, under the current rate of erosion and movement of the Nisqually River, it's very likely to jump its channel and take out the north and southbound lanes of I-5. What the USGS was not able to determine was if we were to have a major avulsion event, a big time flood, what the impact of that would be on the timing. And their concern is, and it's shared by the tribe in moving forward with the study, is that that flood event, that major avulsion event, could happen tomorrow. It could happen next week with these atmospheric rivers that dump into the Puget Sound region with long trains of clouds and storms from my homeland in Hawaii, dumping all that rain in the mountains. It's just a matter of time. It's not if, but when I-5 is going to be damaged by this. So the work that we're doing is to try to get ahead of that and to try to create a better environment for fish that protects treaty rights and southern resident killer whales, but is also respective and responsible to the transportation needs and national security needs in the region. So it's a really unique project. It's very exciting to be involved in it and to have multiple players with different interests all pulling in the same direction. It's just been a great project. That's
so
a lot.
How do you think we can, there is a lot. How do you think we can make I-5 more compatible with the river ecosystem, the salmon life cycle, salmon habitat, and public safety?
That's a great question. And it brings me back to many moments when I had a chance to spend time with Billy Frank, my mentor and the tribal leader who hired me back at Nisqually in 1987. He loved to go to this restaurant in Hawkesbury called the Hawkesbury Inn, and they were famous for their corned beef hash, but they were also famous for using paper placemats, and Billy loved paper placemats. On the front side was the menu, but on the back side was just plain white paper, and he loved to draw and loved for us to draw for him. And I remember sitting there with him having breakfast and taking care of his young son, Willie Frank, the third at the time, and Billy flipped over one of the placemats and said, all right, I want you to describe for me, and this was like in 1993 or 94, well before the listings, well before salmon recovery really got moving with lots of momentum. So I want you to describe for me the top five things we need to do in the Nisqually to restore our habitat and to build our salmon runs. And we talked about the Nisqually Delta, and we talked about protecting the main stem Nisqually and restoring some of the habitat in the Michelle and the OHOP. But one of the projects that I put at the end of the list was this notion that we need to fix I-5. We could do all the restoration we want in the Delta, but if we don't fix the crossing of the Nisqually Delta by I-5, it will likely be impacted and will not provide the function that we want. And Billy thought that was such a great kind of project to take on. And immediately he ran to his vision and he said, David, what I want you to draw this. And I am not good at drawing, but I tried my best. I want you to draw the Lions Gate Bridge from British Columbia that would span from Hawks Prairie at JBLM. From JBLM all the way across the valley to Hawks Prairie, a high elevated bridge that would be an engineering marvel and a tourist attraction and just a spectacular thing. And so Billy's vision was, we need to lift it completely off the Nisqually Delta from one bluff to the next. And that is certainly one of the options that we'll be considering as we move forward through the NEPA process in the next couple of years. It's likely to be incredibly expensive. And I remember Billy and I talking about it at the time in 1992 or 93 and thinking it was probably around $10 billion. And I would guess it's probably double that now. So unless we can find $20 billion in our couch cushions, we're probably going to have to find something that is a little more realistic in terms of cost, but still provides the functions to fish. And so ultimately what we're talking about is going back to the original design. Let's go back to an elevated causeway across the Nisqually Delta, put it back on piers, allow for the river to move freely upstream and downstream, and allow the habitat to be restored. And then the long-term vision, working with our partner at the now appropriately named Billy Frank Jr. National Wildlife Refuge, Glennis Nakai, who's the manager there, and she's just fabulous. We have a great partnership. Working with her to say, well, within the next 20 years, what we want is to relocate all of the structures from the wildlife refuge upstream into the McAllister Valley and allow all that habitat down there to be completely restored, and then create a distributary channel through the Nisqually Valley that would deliver sediment and fish into different spots within the estuary and really create a fully functioning estuary in the Nisqually Delta that would be the prize of salmon recovery, but also the real centerpiece for our ability to educate the public and connect the public to the kind of work that we're doing. So that's sort of the long-term vision. Fix I-5, relocate the refuge, and recreate natural conditions down there to support fish, but also with the ability to have transportation go through, maybe expand the lanes of I-5, maybe put in a light rail for Sounder eventually to come down in Thurston County, and do it all at once. Let's just get it all done while we're doing it. And I just think it's a great project.
I like it. So have you drawn this one?
We have some preliminary drawings, although we're going to have to get serious and have some engineers do it, because my chicken scratch just isn't high quality enough to build a bridge by. But we have some ideas, and it really will depend to some extent on the monies available to us. The creating causeways is expensive, especially when you have the current condition to have to deal with. But our back of the envelope calculations are somewhere between $3 and $5 billion, depending on how much we need to do. And if there's a desire to do lane expansion on I-5, would drive the cost up closer to the $5 billion number.
Well, speaking of that, thinking big about I-5, in what ways do you think our use of infrastructure needs to change throughout the Puget Sound region to contribute to salmon recovery and account for the risks posed by climate change?
Well, I think that there's a large role that our infrastructure can play in supporting habitat functions. And as this region continues to grow, if we have another 2 million people moving into Puget Sound, we're undoubtedly going to have to be building new roads and repairing existing roads. And so we need to be building these in a way that are much more fish friendly, and have as part of the outcome from the construction of these infrastructure pieces, improvements in the environmental quality and quantity of the area. So we're working with WashDOT to use this I-5 crossing as a model for how you can deal with things like transportation, national security, and salmon recovery treaty rights with a transportation project that just doesn't mitigate for its footprint, but at the end of the day creates a condition that was much better than when it started. And that's where I think we need to be going as a region. Let's have as our goal, as we learned in national parks and with our kids, to leave it better than you found it. Let's have that be our goal for all major capital projects in Puget Sound region. Leave the area they're in better than when they found it. And so with new construction and replacement of capital infrastructure, I think that makes a lot of sense. We've got to be forward thinking and forward leaning about climate change and making sure that what we build today makes sense in 20 and 50 and 100 years. And that's why it's going to be important to elevate roadways across a lot of these wetlands and streams. We also need to be thinking about the inputs that are coming off of the roads from our vehicles and our lives, and how those things are impacting salmon. And so being creative and providing for new kinds of treatment opportunities for stormwater to deal with things like the tire dust, which has just been elevated to a major concern through the science of the University of Washington, WSU, to indicate that it is killing coho. And it doesn't take much of it or a very long exposure to it to kill these fish. And it's coming off our roads every time it rains. And so we need to be retrofitting all of our roadways to make sure we can treat these toxic issues. And then finally, I would say, as we're investing a tremendous amount of money in infrastructure, and I mentioned, for example, the Nisqually project, you know, maybe $5 billion, maybe by the time we get to construction, maybe $6 or $7 billion. That's a lot of money. And so one of the ideas that we're pursuing at Nisqually is that all of these major public investments of taxpayers' dollars should include, as a newly defined mitigation requirement, an improved environmental baseline. And I think the one way to accomplish that would be to say, for every major capital project, we're going to set aside 3% of the budget of that project for this newly defined mitigation. And a lot of that work should occur and will occur on or near the location of the project itself. But if we're able to generate enough money, we could really reach out and to affect habitats that may be somewhat distant from the project, but would have significant benefits to those populations that are impacted by the project. So for example, with the Seattle tunnel that went through, if I remember correctly, it was about $5 billion. That seems to be a popular number for big road projects. If you were to take 3% of that and apply it to this improved conditions kind of mitigation standard, that'd be $150 million to be able to work with. That's the kind of money we have never seen in the salmon recovery world in a single year to do the kind of work that needs to get done. And if we're going to be successful in the face of a growing population and a booming economy that are all putting stresses on our natural environment and stresses on the salmon that we love so much, we're going to have to invest in it in a significant way to protect it, or we're going to lose it. And we can see the pathway in front of us. We see we're at the fork in the road, and the choice is ours, and it's time to choose. And by not choosing, by not doing anything, by maintaining status quo, that is a choice. And so we're advocating that we make an aggressive choice. Let's truly pay for the cost of being here and living here and growing here by protecting the things that we love so much. And so some connection to our public investment in these capital projects, whether it be roadways or stormwater facilities or new drinking water facilities or wastewater treatment facilities, those are all big taxpayer investments. Let's tap those to redefine mitigation to provide a better place at the end of the day than it was at the beginning of the day. And so those are the kind of things we're pursuing here at Nisqually that I think have a bigger regional impact if we're successful.
Pretty amazing. I am wondering, given the scope of your vision, the big transformative nature of those ideas, what gives you hope as you think about the work that is in front of us over the next 10 to 20 years? That we will actually make those choices, the not the status quo choice, but the transformative choice?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess there are some things out there that definitely give me hope. And one of the things that gives me hope are the salmon themselves. They are just absolutely incredible animals that can hatch in the river, migrate downstream into Puget Sound, out into the ocean, spend 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 years out there, migrate all the way back, find the exact place where they were born 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, and do it all over again. And they do it by using the stars and by using their nose and by internal compasses. They're incredible animals. And what we've learned, if we just give them a chance, they'll survive. In spite of ourselves, they'll survive. So it won't take much for us to make a difference and have salmon survive with us. We just have to be willing to make that difference. And so the fish themselves give me hope. And then, you know, recently we're watching the news and we're seeing all these great, amazing shots come back from Mars. And the ability for us to get to Mars multiple times successfully, and not just us, but other countries and private companies and just people to be able to go that far and do science and come back, is remarkable achievement. If we can do that, there is no reason why we can't figure out how to live in Puget Sound and have salmon with us. And I know the people in this region care a lot about Puget Sound and care a lot about salmon. And I know that they want to do the right thing. And if given the opportunity, we'll do the right thing. And so that gives me a lot of hope as well. I think people are part of the challenge that we have to overcome, but they're also the solution if we're going to make progress in this. And so those kind of things give me hope.
And for those people who do want to do the right thing, who do want to get involved, what would you recommend?
I think there's lots of ways for citizens to get involved. If they want to get out and get their feet wet and their hands dirty, every one of our watersheds has groups that are working in the field, revegetating forest and working on salmon restoration projects, and are always looking for volunteers, even in this time of COVID. The Nisqually Land Trust just had a big planting project this past weekend, and we had 45 volunteers show up, and they were socially distanced and masked up, and it was rainy, but they were out there planting trees because it made importance for them. It was something that was significant for them and their family to do. So opportunities to get in the watershed and be participating in those things directly. I think if that's not what's in it for you, then I think there are opportunities to let the leaders in the region know what's important to you. And so by reaching out to your city councils and your county councils and your state elected officials and your federal elected officials and tell them, Salmon's important. We need to figure this out. We need to be here together. We need your help in doing this. Could be a major role in us all being successful. So whether it's getting your hands wet or typing emails on your computer to your local elected officials, there are lots of ways for folks to get involved and make a difference. And that's what's really important is making that difference.
I agree. And what would you say are the most significant lessons that you've learned in your time working toward environmental recovery and environmental justice?
Well, I think the lessons I've learned were taught to me by Billy. And he was the most incredible person I've ever met for a number of reasons. One is that he spent a lifetime fighting the system and fighting for his treaty rights and going to jail 56 times and ultimately prevailing in the federal courts in 1974 with the Bolt decision. And then he realized that it was time to do something different. And then it was time to get the people together and get the tribes together and get all our communities together to do something about fish. This was 1977, and he was already talking about salmon recovery in 1977. So he knew how to shift gears. And that's one of the most important lessons that I learned from Billy, was that there is definitely a time to fight, but there's always a time to try to reach out to your neighbors and build coalitions and build families that care about salmon and get them out there and do something about it. And so understanding when that time is, and the time is now, to build these coalitions is really important. And the other thing, and it's come through a lot of time on the Nisqually working a lot of projects. I'm thinking back to dealing with the Braggett family and making sure that the family needs were met as we were talking about buying their land to convert it back to the Nisqually estuary functioning habitats that we needed for fish, that it takes a long time. It takes a lot of cups of coffee. It takes personal relationships to get these things done. And you don't just walk into a farmer's door and say, I want to buy your property. How much? Let's write a check. That's not going to last long. You're not even going to get to the kitchen for a cup of coffee. But spending some time with them and learning who they are and understanding why they're there, and then trying to find a path forward that solves their issues and accomplishes their goals as well as yours. And the Braggett one is such a great example of, it took 15 years to negotiate with Ken and his mom until she passed to build a relationship where they trusted us enough to sell it to us, because they'd been in their family for over 100 years. And in return, we knew exactly what Ken wanted. Ken wanted to spend his life on the land and die on his farm being a farmer. And so we created a life estate for him. And he eventually did, unfortunately, pass on. But he did it in his house, on his farm. And he was so proud of the work that we'd done that he said a number of times that he went from growing cows to growing fish. And he really reveled in that role as a steward of the land that he had stewarded all his life, but now in a different way. So patience and perseverance and knowing when to bring communities and people together are great lessons I've learned, and I think would serve others well as well.
That is a fabulous story.
Thanks.
And I wonder, David, speaking of Billy Frank Jr., who I was fortunate to meet but only once, if he were here today, what do you think he would say to us?
Well, Billy always liked to say that salmon recovery is like climbing a mountain. You have to do one step at a time and you have to keep moving. And he recognized in the 70s, he recognized throughout his life that it's a long journey and it's going to be a struggle. I think he would look around now and see some of the work that we've done here at Nisqually and some of the work that the partnerships had a role in playing. He was so proud of the partnership and his involvement there. And some of the work that all the communities up and down Puget Sound and in Hood Canal have done, I think he'd be proud of all that work and all the community building that we've all done around salmon. But I think he'd be frustrated. He'd be frustrated in watching that when I started in 1987, we were fishing 105 days out of the year sustainably, as we had been for generations before. And in 2015, we fished 8 days. And so he would be incredibly frustrated that we're not going fast enough, and that the treaty rights that he fought so hard for, that he went to jail for, that many of his family died for, were not being honored in a significant way. Our intentions are good, but if we don't have the support of the full region. If we don't have the resources necessary to get the job done, it just makes that mountain a lot taller and our steps a lot smaller. And so I think he would be proud and happy, but also frustrated and motivated to keep walking up that mountain.
I think he'd be proud of you, David, for continuing to tell the truth, tell your story. I take that to heart, the importance of telling the truth.
It's going to make me cry.
What's the last thing you read that you really enjoyed or that stuck with you?
Oh, that's a really good question. There's a new book that just came out by a friend of mine who's an author in the Nisqually Valley. And I'm trying to find it so I can give you the title of it. But it's all about the development of the Nisqually Valley and all the families involved, including the Braggett family. And it really is around Ken Braggett and his mom. It's called For the Good of the Order. Tim Ransom is the author, a good friend of mine. And it's fabulous. He does a great job of telling the history of the Nisqually Valley that I didn't know. And I've learned so much reading it and have reconnected with some of the players that have passed that I knew, and including Kenny. And just the reading of his book has brought back Kenny's voice into my ear. And Kenny had a very distinctive voice, and also the sound of his shotgun, which he liked to shoot a lot when you were nearby at his house. And so that's the book that I just recently completed, and I highly recommend to anyone else. And it's impactful for those of us who work and love the Nisqually, which should be everybody.
That's right. Isn't it the center of the universe, David?
It is indeed the center of the known universe, yes. I got Steve Theringer in a committee meeting about 2 weeks ago to admit that the Nisqually is the center of the known universe.
Whoa. We won't tell his constituents.
Yeah.
Well, David, I appreciate this so much. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today and share your story with us, your insights, and the great work that you do. And I look forward to supporting your work to fix I-5, get it off the Nisqually Delta, prevent massive flood, and save some fish. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Laura, and thank you for your work and your agency's work and building partnerships, because it really is about partnerships if we're going to get things done. And I'm so proud to be working with you and all of your staff and the great work you guys do together. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested in more content like this, visit www.makingwaves.psb.wa.gov.